You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at opensocietyfoundations.org.
It's a great pleasure to have Gerald Knaus here, the executive director and founder since 1999 of the European Stability Initiative. Gerald goes back and forth, Istanbul, Paris, Berlin, rough life. But someone's got to do it.
Harvard.
And published, is 2 years ago this came out? 18
yeah,
months?
Yeah.
Can Intervention Work? With Rory Stewart, better known some people, Rory the Tory.
No.
The walking Tory.
Pretends to be.
Pretends to be. Is he an MP right now?
Yes.
He's an MP.
Yes.
Okay. But we're fortunate to have Gerald here. This is being taped, and Gerald's going to talk about broader challenges to the human rights narrative, something that clearly we are contending with on an ongoing basis here, successfully or otherwise. And Gerald's going to talk for maybe 15, 18 minutes. You want to talk more?
Well,
or 25?
I don't know.
I just want to make sure there's time for good questions and answers as well. So welcome.
Thank you. Well, thanks a lot for this opportunity. Lots of good friends here. So it's almost like a conversation in a pub. And I think I can assume a lot about the issues I'll talk about. But let me still start with a very concrete story. The story, as anybody who talks about human rights today, should probably be placed in Ukraine. A Ukrainian woman about which I know relatively little, but would like to know more. Her name is Vera. I was told that her family were Cossacks. She was Russian-speaking, was born in Ukraine in the 1920s. Allegedly a good student, and like millions of Ukrainians in the Second World War, she ended up in Germany. There was this massive program of transporting millions of, voluntary, but then it turned into slave laborers to Germany. She gave birth to a child in Berlin in 1944. She named her Peace, but Berlin in 1944 was not a good place to grow up. The father was a German who was married, who was actually involved in moving Ukrainian laborers to Germany. I know very little about him, and he disappeared. The child was taken to the countryside. The Red Army came to Berlin, sentenced her, and executed her in Berlin in 1945. So the child remained stateless, was never picked up, grew up in the Austrian Alps, and was my mother. She got her citizenship at age 14. Until then, she didn't know who her real parents were. And she grew up as a good Austrian Catholic. Now, the interesting thing about this story, of which there are millions in Europe, is that anybody who scratches the surface in Europe actually has a story like that. So if we talk today about European values and defending European democracy and human rights as under the blue and stars flag of the European Union, we often forget just how extremely recent this association of Europe with human rights really is. There have been a great number of books, and you probably know most of them, from Mark Mazzova's Dark Continent, about his great description of the 1930s, to Keith Lowe's book, The Savage Continent, about Europe after World War II. And if one reads these books, if one discovers that in Germany in 1945, when the war ended, there were literally millions of slaves. Of course, torture had been reintroduced on a massive scale, slavery, executions, genocide. Then one realizes on what a recent fragile basis the human rights architecture really rests that we have today. Another Ukrainian woman I met in 1993 when I went to work in Ukraine also symbolizes this. Her name was Lydia. She was born in the last year of the Habsburg monarchy, a refugee from the First World War in Vienna. She grew up in Romania. Her religion was literature. But since she was Jewish, she was also taken to a Romanian camp. On the wall of her apartment, where she was teaching students languages in the 1990s, was Thomas Mann. Her native tongue was German. And again, her life, of course, shows us that this, as we all know, this repression continued in half the continent until the end of the Soviet Union. In fact, when she was teaching in the 1990s, she was one of the very few women in her village in Ukraine, on the border with Romania, who kept the vision that somehow one could go back to the old days, to the early 20th century, when indeed, she was told by her parents, one could easily go to Vienna, there were no borders. And there was this very benign monarch, Franz Joseph, and I couldn't quite convince her that he was not the solution for the European future. If we look at European politics in the last few years, one of the most powerful myths was really this myth of a return to a normality in which Europe would be democratic. But if we think for a second about what we are currently engaged in, what has happened the last 20 years, we discover that the idea of a Europe of open borders and liberal democracies, integrated and peaceful, is a radically new option, completely unprecedented, and that it is extremely recent. I mean, this is why I like this book, because what Samuel Moyn describes is a world, and I think it's very much true for Europe, where for a very long time, until literally yesterday, the idea that human rights were the basic mobilizing philosophy was very alien. I mean, I live in Turkey now, and again, just to put it into context, Turkey, of course, saw the expulsion of its Christian Istanbul community, the Greeks of Istanbul, exactly 50 years ago. It started in 1964. They were spared the population exchange at the creation of the Republic. They were expelled when Turkey was already in the Council of Europe, when Turkey was already a member of NATO, 200,000 people within 15 years. And there was very little complaint. So what is it that protects, well, first of all, what is it that has driven the change in the last 20 years? And what is it that protects us from falling back? This is all the more urgent, as clearly in many parts of Europe, things are moving backwards. Again, I come from Turkey, where the narrative the last 15 years, well, the last 10 years, to be more precise, was based on real facts of a gradual extension of, again, European values. Torture, which was ubiquitous, was being stopped. There was more freedom of speech. Taboos were being discussed openly. Politics became more inclusive. The military was pushed out of politics. As we see today, this trend is very much under assault. And all the old questions about zero-sum politics, autocratic rule, and the destruction of legal institutions are back on the agenda. We see that in the Balkans, and of course we see it in Ukraine, where the option, the certainty that Ukraine is moving in a given direction, it suffices to look at the news, and we know that it is completely unclear if the vision of Lydia Harnik that she had 20 years ago is still true. So what do we have on which we can base, as activists, as NGOs, as intellectuals, the project of completing, or rather, to take the myth of returning to a Europe that never existed, the Europe of liberal democracies based on human rights? Now, there is this document, the European Convention of Human Rights, which was signed in November 1950 in a Roman palace. The idea behind that convention, again, Semoyn describes it as a rather radical document. It is one of the most rigorous human rights regimes. It brings with it a court, European Court of Human Rights. 800 million people can, in theory, all individually appeal to that court for the protection of their rights. The idea behind this was to create a spiritual union, as Churchill put it at the time, an early warning device against autocratic restoration, against the drift to authoritarianism. The original idea behind this was not yet that individuals would go to a court, but that states would take each other to court, so that states would actually protect rights by interfering in each other's affairs. Where are we now with this? Well, the obvious thing is, of course, that there is an incomplete enlargement of these European institutions created in the 50s. But some of them have been enlarged, and there we discover the drawbacks or the challenges of an enlargement that has gone wrong. And here I'm referring to the Council of Europe. It's an institution that is not often focused on among policymakers or among the media, but it is one that we've stumbled across in the last few years in the context of our work in Eastern Europe. Now, the Council of Europe is allegedly, as I've said, a spiritual union of democracies. It's linked to the court, it's linked to the convention. It's only part of the very dense network, the forest of institutions we have in Europe. There is, of course, also the OECD. There are many commissioners for different aspects of human rights. And then there's the European Union. But the Council of Europe is particular because it also includes countries like Russia, Ukraine, Azerbaijan, and, of course, has included Turkey almost from the very beginning, from 1950. And what we've seen in the last few years, the Council of Europe embodied this idea that enlargement would be the solution to problems. You know, you join And then once you're in, even if you're not perfect at the beginning, you would gradually move in a certain direction through peer pressure and through the existing instruments. What we've seen in the last 5 years is that the opposite has happened. The autocrats of the East have discovered, while the democrats of the West have been largely indifferent, that it's very useful to have the legitimacy of democracy as a battle in their domestic wars against dissidents. So to have election observers from Strasbourg come and say the elections in Azerbaijan are free and fair is an extremely useful instrument when you're confronting young dissidents, because it shows them just how isolated they really are. So what we've seen in the last few years is that the autocrats of the East have used their membership of these institutions in concerted campaigns, very well strategized, building up alliances. And what we've seen just in the last year has been really quite extraordinary. We had election votes in the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe in Strasbourg, which is made up of members of the parliaments of all the member states. So they are the Dutch and the German and the Swiss, but also the Russian and Turkish and Azerbaijani MPs. And we've had votes there where every time Azerbaijan is on the agenda, a new record in terms of the quorum is reached. There are never more people there than when it's a vote on Azerbaijan. And Azerbaijan consistently defeats or wins with its allies every vote that is in any way critical. This alliance is really an alliance of Azerbaijan together with Russia, together with Turkey. They always all work together. But they also have a lot of supporters in the West. And the result of this is that in autumn 2012, we had a vote there on the concept of political prisoner. And you all know from the 1970s how key this notion of political prisoners was for the early dissidents like Sakharov and, of course, the Czechs. And a vote on the concept of political prisoners where the Council of Europe came within one vote, the assembly of all these Democrats, of ruling that the very notion is meaningless and that the Parliamentary Assembly and the Council of Europe should be silent on this and actually should leave it all to the court. And what the Azerbaijanis and the Russians have found out is that the game of a prisoner carousel, where you always arrest enough people, you intimidate them, you keep them in prison, then the pressure builds up, then you let them out, you pay the European court, you pay some damages, but you arrest the next bunch, that this is an extremely efficient way to manipulate the institutions. Now, in that vote, the Democrats, the Italians, the Spanish, the Poles, I mean, the Central European MPs in that assembly were among the worst in terms of voting. They've all been courted for the last 5 years, systematically invited to Baku, supported in many ways. We called it caviar diplomacy. We can't write everything we know because our sources in Azerbaijan are afraid. But it is very clear that these institutions have been captured. But what is more interesting is that this has happened to total indifference. Hardly any think tank in Europe, hardly any media have really written about it. The same is true for election observation, which
except
I think...
Except ESI.
Well, recently. I didn't really know much about the Council of Europe until 3-4 years ago. The same is true, I think, for election observation. Here, too, the last few years have seen the creation of an alternative industry. Lots of quengo institutions in France, in Germany, in Belgium, are former senators, are former politicians, who are basically for hire. Now, this is obviously, they go and observe elections in Kazakhstan, Russia, and Azerbaijan. They always find elections are free and fair. They spend 2 days there. They get lots of gifts. They are very well paid. But the more interesting thing isn't the mercenaries like this. It's that the OSCE Parliamentary Assembly or the Council of Europe Parliamentary Assembly, which are consisting of elected officials, are doing the same thing. So we've had two recent elections in Azerbaijan where they've always found elections to be free and fair. So what we are seeing here is that we are losing our vocabulary. I mean, if autocracy is democracy, if autocratic consolidation is democratic transition, if non-competitive elections are free and fair, then in fact it's not only about Azerbaijan. Then what are the standards we are applying to other countries in much less obvious black and white situations, like Hungary, like Turkey, like Georgia? If political prisoners, if these ideas, if these notions cannot be defended by the institutions of which these countries are members, Ilham Aliyev recently went to Brussels. He stood next to the NATO General Secretary. He was asked by journalists about political prisoners, and with a big, broad smile, and we have the video clip on our website, he said, the most respected human rights organization in the world, the Council of Europe, has confirmed there are no political prisoners here. So, you journalists, what are you asking about? And, of course, neither Barroso in a previous meeting nor the NATO General Secretary have said anything. So we are, in a strange way, further behind than we were in the 70s or 80s, when we seemed to know what dissidents were, when the Council of Europe had some sort of idea of what a democracy was. Until 2004 and 2005, we seemed to have some sort of confidence that we could really tell a fake election from a real one. And I'm not really sure anymore whether this is true. But in a strange way, what we are seeing here also is the power of ideas and concepts. Why are these regimes putting so much emphasis on manipulating institutions, which actually have no real influence? You know, the Council of Europe can do little else, in the worst case, than issue a condemnation. And why is it then that when there is sufficient pressure, moral pressure, media pressure, pressure on the legitimacy, that these regimes consistently and always release political prisoners so that it actually appears to work, the pressure, but it is not sustained? It is that, in fact, being able to claim that you are a democracy, being able to claim that you have no political prisoners and free and fair elections, is a very powerful source of legitimacy. So what is to be done in this context by activist organizations or think tanks that believe still in the notion of one Europe, whole and free? Well, one thing is we need to work on not losing our language. If we are in favor of, for example, further European Union enlargement, and we then go to the Dutch or German parliament, what we are meeting is members of parliament who say, look, we don't believe any of these institutions anymore, neither the Council of Europe nor the European Commission, when they tell us that these countries meet European standards, because you know, we don't trust it, because our experience, we've been disappointed so often. If we don't have a credible language and assessment mechanisms that convince skeptics in the EU and in Western Europe, if we cannot make a success of Council of Europe enlargement, which is so much more less significant than EU enlargement, then the case for example, offering an EU perspective to Ukraine and convincing the Dutch or the Germans to take it seriously is going to be very difficult. And that, of course, is the key problem. The vision of Europe, whole and free is still there in the rhetoric, but unless it is taken seriously and is credible on two sides, credible with the countries which offer the perspective and credible with the politicians and representatives, members of parliament in the EU, saying to a country where you might join one day, Kosovo, Albania, is not going to be very mobilizing because nobody really believes it. So one of the challenges for us, and this is where we have been very active in the last year, is, for example, working with the European Commission so that when it writes its assessments, its annual progress reports on accession countries, these accession reports are actually, and there are political criteria in there, these are actually comprehensible and are read by anybody. What we've discovered is that very few people, even the Commission, read these reports. It's not clear who they are for. And when we talk to Dutch members in the Foreign Ministry, when they summarize them for the Dutch Parliament, they say, well, this is really extremely painful. Basically, when the Commission tells us Macedonia is doing fine, you know, we don't believe it. When the Commission tells us Albania is ready to open accession talks, we don't believe it. When the Commission tells us something about Turkey, we don't believe it. So one of the challenges is to make assessments credible, to restore some clarity, less confusion, less fuzziness to our concepts, to restore the notion that there are red lines which we can recognize, against which we can hold countries. And not to do that in an intellectual way that is incomprehensible, but in a way that an intelligent 14-year-old can understand. Not in a lawyerly language that will only prevail in the court, but in a way that journalists can pick up. So if we say that Turkey today does not have basic freedom of religion because it is impossible for any religion to register as a legal entity, it's just there's no law that allows it, and state this clearly, we would actually have the sort of message that civil society in Turkey could rally around. It's the kind of message we gave to the Turks 10 years ago on the military. The military must not interfere. That was a clear message. Finding ways to say this about freedom of speech, however, of free and fair elections, is much more difficult. And I think here the conceptual work really needs to be done. In our discussions with the Commission and the new Director General of DG Enlargement in the last few months on this, we've recommended that one should focus less on the mechanics, what's inside the box, and more on the outputs. Because the game that these autocrats, and now I'm including some members of the European Union, are playing, when they are criticized, is they say, well, but this rule we have seen in Britain, and that law exists in England, and this is also a rule you have in Austria. But the end result, to just take the example of Turkey, is that when something very big happens in Turkey, like on Taksim Square, the protests last summer, and the mainstream media doesn't report, it doesn't really matter what the reason is. We know there is no freedom of speech. So what we are recommending is to find a way to look at the outcome, less on the mechanics on the inside. So to say to a government in Macedonia or Turkey or who knows in 5 years in Serbia or Georgia, to say to them, look, we will do what the ODIHR has done before elections. We will look for a month what is actually on your main television. You know, are there public debates with different opinions? Are different voices actually being heard? And then we don't care whether it is self-censorship or commercial interests or laws or defamation laws or intimidation. If you don't have free public debates, it's your problem to create that. But for us, this is a red line that cannot be crossed. So I think it's quite striking, there is on some of these issues, and the same is true in terms of red lines for election monitoring, on some of these issues, and almost the need to go back to first principles, to have a more clear language, to take back the language of basic European standards from the experts and from the lawyers, and to recognize that while we have this dense jungle of institutions, and no other continent has as many as Europe, unless these concepts are clear and not muddled, they don't help us. We also need to build more alliances. If the autocrats have built alliances in the Council of Europe, the democrats have not. So what is it that prevents the Swedes and the Germans and the Swiss and the Irish and the Austrians and others who've voted against Azerbaijan or Russia to come together more effectively? We need to seize opportunities. One of the most interesting stories in the last year in defending of human rights was the ability to link some human rights to things like visa liberalization, which is extremely popular. The big battle in Moldova in the last 2 years was actually on non-discrimination of sexual minorities. Moldova was asked to pass a law on non-discrimination as one of the conditions of getting visa-free travel. Why did interior ministers insist on this in the EU to say to Moldovans you can travel visa-free to Schengen if you have a non-discrimination law? They said, well, if you don't have a non-discrimination law and we lift the visas, everybody will come and apply for asylum. So you need to get your human rights in order. For the NGOs in Moldova, however, this was, and some of these NGOs were actually Russians who came from Russia, and some of these activists saw this as a way to take a stance against this wave of homophobic attacks and campaigns led in Moldova as well as in Russia or Ukraine or Georgia by the Orthodox Church together with the former Communist Party, and to actually force politicians to take a stance. By linking LGBT rights to visa liberalization, it was actually possible, and in Moldova, of course, the law was passed. The court actually also struck down certain other regulations in cities, which, like in Russia, declared themselves cities free of gay propaganda. It was possible to actually turn this issue into one that could get popular and political support. And finally, my last point, defend the credibility of the bigger vision. It is very easy at a moment like this to give up on the notion that Europe, whole and free, a continent in which borders are permeable and physical borders disappear, and in which liberal democracies interfere in each other's affairs and thereby hold each other to account, and in which red lines can be policed by institutions, that this vision is no longer possible. But as we see, after every shock in the last 20 years, and it was always a shock, the response by policymakers was to grasp for an instrument that might work, and it always ended up being enlargement. And I go back to an American who actually articulated this philosophy best in 1993, and he didn't think of the EU then, Anthony Lake, who gave a presentation in 1993 where he said, we need to replace the policy of containment after the Cold War with a policy of enlargement. And what he meant was, of course, the idea of enlarging all institutions of liberal democracies, as the Americans had done so successfully after the Second World War in Western Europe. So this vision is still the best tool we have. And after the Bosnian War, it was only in 1997 that the EU decided to open accession talks with the Poles and the Hungarians and three others. After the Kosovo War, the EU decided to open accession talks with Romania, Bulgaria, and others. When Macedonia stumbled into civil war in 2001, which was narrowly avoided, the EU realized we need to do something and promised the Balkans something. And our hope is that the image of snipers in Kiev and the prospect of a big and important country tumbling into civil unrest on the border of many EU member states might lead the EU to think more seriously about a policy of enlargement also for Ukraine. And I think with this, I think there's a very big agenda for activist NGOs and think tanks and institutions like OSF to make a difference. So that perhaps one day even Ukraine and the former bloodlands of Europe, as Timothy Snyder called them, are part of the liberal Europe of integrated democracies. And I hope that wasn't too long.
Perfect. No, thank you, Gerald. That was great. That was just great. Hi, Anthony.
Hi.
No. We're going to open this up to comments and questions. Maybe I can just kick things off, Gerald, because this was immensely thoughtful and provocative. You speak a lot about taking back the discourse, taking back the sort of language currently dominating European political social debate. So it's unclear specifically who the unit of analysis, who we're specifically identifying, who's going to be doing the taking back. Is it your assumption that NGOs and think tanks are in a position to, in fact, refashion and reimagine a language to have that kind of clarity to a 14-year-old whom you would like to understand what the fault lines or the red line in which one cannot pass? What is the actual unit of analysis that we're looking at?
Well, I think what we've seen in the Council of Europe was very interesting in the last few elections. There was a very clear geographic, sometimes it was ideological like in the UK, but usually it was geographic division. I mean, in the UK, it's very clear the British Conservative Party sides with the autocrats. They are actually in a party faction with Yanukovych, Putin, and Aliyev in the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe, which means much more than just voting occasionally. They are literally on almost every issue they vote together. This is a strategy of the British Tories, which I think now I want to just embarrass them much more about. I know they are very embarrassed when you talk to them in private, but it's not been enough of an issue in the British press. But otherwise, in other countries, it's basically all the Spaniards are always with the autocrats. Most of the Italians are. In Italy, it's purely commercial policy. You know, you visit the Italian foreign ministry and you have, you know, the big books of Azerbaijan, the future of energy policy on the desk. And of course, you know, Eni is very active in the East, both in Russia and Azerbaijan. It's the Turks. But on the other side, your question is who one could mobilize against this. And here the interesting thing is that countries like, and there are of course a lot of countries who might care if they would focus on this, and when we talk to them, they begin to care, like the Scandinavians, the Balts, some of the Central Europeans, though not the new democracies. Astonishingly, Poland is completely absent, and I still haven't fully understood why the Poles have been. Some of the Czechs, the Austrians, the Germans, the Swiss, the Dutch, the Danes. I mean, there is a potential, and I think there is still a sufficient number of people who care about these visions. When you ask the Germans, there was a survey in IRD a month ago on Ukraine. When you ask them if they can imagine Ukraine in the EU, it's very interesting that 60% think Ukraine will be in the EU in the next 20 years. Of course, the question is what kind of Ukraine? I mean, a Ukrainian democracy. But I think if you link the agenda of reform, if you mobilize the people who believe and share this vision of a Europe of democracies, you can mobilize a lot of people. Now, the new human rights envoy in the German government was actually that envoy. I mean, Christoph Stresser, I just visited him 2 weeks ago. He actually was the envoy who proposed the definition of political prisoners in the Council of Europe and was almost voted down, and then was voted down with his report in Azerbaijan. Now, he is now the human rights envoy in Berlin. He is interested in doing something. I know in Sweden they're interested because they find themselves constantly outvoted. I went to the Swiss foreign ministry, and the Swiss are always very careful. But they are worried also because these institutions matter to them more because they're not in the EU. So I think coalitions of intellectual think tanks, civil society, but also governments, to take back. Otherwise, you know, these institutions are really useless. Otherwise, you know, we should really start a debate on. But I actually think they are not useless because they the debates in those institutions helps us to formulate our concepts, which then can help dissidents and the new critical minds in those countries to use that vocabulary.
So the language right now is not so debased that it doesn't have an opportunity of being.
No, I think it's really like this wonderful book on New York, The World Without Us. You know, if you stop for a few weeks to maintain the pumps, the metro will be flooded. I mean, if you don't have engineers to maintain the infrastructure of a city, if you imagine New York without people, within 20 years it's a jungle again. And I think that's true for all these institutions. And I think what the think tanks haven't done enough, and what policy institutes in Europe haven't done enough is, you know, we've had these fantasy debates on Europe as a great power and what Europe should do in Asia and what Europe should do. I mean, this is bizarre. In the meantime, we haven't focused in the last 10 years on the immediate neighborhood where we have some tools. Our own institutions, which have been, you know, a bit like, you know, a place that isn't maintained, the garden that grows wild. I think that's where we need to start. Because all these institutions, and this is, I think, the key lesson that what Samoyn is also pointing out, all this vocabulary of human rights, all these values, are constantly under assault. The Orwellian vision of newspeak, you know, a language where these concepts become meaningless, that's always a risk. Unless we, what is it, Voltaire wrote in Candide at the very end, you know, let us all become gardeners. He didn't believe the Panglossian vision of this doctor who told him this is the best of all possible worlds, but he didn't want to be a total pessimist. So he said, you know, let's look in after our garden. And I think that's the philosophy we need also.
Great, great, great. Comments, questions, Ivan?
First of all, thank you very much. I do believe it was a great presentation. But three questions. First, let's go to Ukraine, because Ukraine also tells us an interesting story. One of the reasons we have this revolution in Ukraine was that European Union was not principled on human rights. If European Union was principled on human rights, they should not have offered, because of the Tymoshenko case, any kind of offer to Ukraine. If they're not going to be offering Ukraine, most probably, you're not going to have, at least at this moment, triggering of the crisis that we see there. Ukraine is also interesting from a different point of view, that the first thing that the new post-Yanukovych government did is basically went against the rights of some minority group, basically the Russian language speakers. And when basically Gerald is saying why the Poles, who normally should be very much interested in rights and not interested, there is a very simple explanation, geopolitical interest. They're interested in human rights, but they're interested in Russia more. So from this point of view, Azerbaijan for them is much more perceived as a strategic ally. They're very much afraid. I do believe this is extremely important, because in a certain way, I see the problem of the human rights now, and I do believe you absolutely beautifully showed how certain institutions are captured. But certain institutions are captured because we're trying to keep the human rights discourse and our human rights advocacy out of political context. And this is a principal issue. We're not talking politics, we are talking human rights. But this creates a problem on two issues. As you know, United Kingdom now are very seriously discussing to get out of the human rights charter, European Human Rights Convention. They basically said, we are not going to agree with the decision of the European Court on Human Rights, because we basically do not believe that the legal norms can be totally divorced from the political process, from the democratic political process. I do believe this clash between a genuine concern for democracy, because what the autocrats are doing is much more technical game. They're bribing, they're playing, it's a quite intelligent people there, but it's not fundamentally kind of erosive. But you have a major clash between the idea that politics should matter, that people should matter, and from this point of view, this goes back to a very important tradition coming from the French Revolution, where people said democracy is empowering not the individual, but empowering majorities. There is no positive idea of disobedience in the French revolutionary discourse. To be disobedient, it means to be a minority which is opposing the majority. I do believe here is the major story, and I'm going to be very much interested in how it's going to go with your reading. And my last point, it has a lot to do also with the enlargement. To a certain extent, enlargement was based on asserting certain principles and closing your eyes on certain kind of irregularities. if people had been very tough on principles, my own country probably was not going to be in the EU too. And of course, this is going to be much stronger for places like Macedonia and others. So here, you can come for second abuse of human rights, because do you know who have been the two countries, three, most openly defending that European Union should not sign with the Ukraine because of the human rights concerns? There were three countries which are not very famous for their human rights record, like Cyprus, Greece, and Italy, but being very well known for kind of a close relationship with Russia. So human rights discourse, in a way, like any discourse, can be used tactically by anybody. And I do believe this is the major story, how we are not allowing this instrumentalization of the human rights.
Ivan, thank you. Well, maybe some other comments or questions, and then Gerald will respond. Yeah, Sandy.
Well, I guess a specific question. How have visa bans worked? And are there small concrete steps that you can see taking? What do you see coming from the European parliamental elections?
Joe, why don't you comment?
Okay, well, I think when it comes to let me start with visa bans, then go to Ivan's question afterwards. When it comes to visa bans, we've been looking recently into why Bill Browder and the Magnitsky List approaches failed in Europe. You know, he traveled around. You know, this idea of having a Magnitsky List, which was passed by the U.S. Congress, of asset seizure and visa bans for certain people involved in human rights violations in Russia, which was passed in the Congress. But when this American and his team, and he has a lot of money to lobby for this, traveled around Europe, he failed to convince anybody to have similar visa bans or similar asset seizures in other countries. He went to Ireland, he went to the European Parliament, he went to Germany, he went to the Netherlands, and it didn't work. And we asked ourselves why that is, and whether, in fact, a consistent policy of visa bans for human rights violators in the European East could work. I think it could. And it could work much better if it is European. Because, of course, the autocrats in Eastern Europe have their money in Europe, much more than in America. I mean, they have it in London and Paris and Vienna and Prague. And they have their children there, and they have their haven for security when they fall out of favor within their regimes in Europe. I think one reason why that failed, this approach of Bill Browder, and why I'm also not supporting a Magnitsky List style approach in Europe, but something different, is because it was perceived as being arbitrary. You know, you put together a list that wasn't very clear who was on that list. It was basically a political deal in Congress. You know, we offer Russia something on trade, and then in return we pass this bill, and you have a few congressmen holding it up against the State Department. What I think could work, and this is what we've been running around the last few months, is to say, well, I mean, what the Europeans could do, or what, if the EU institutions can't agree now, some member states could do, is create a committee of eminent former judges. Such committees have existed in the past. The Council of Europe had one to look, for example, at cases of Azerbaijani political prisoners in the early 2000s, to assess them and give an opinion. So what a committee of judges, four or five human rights experts, good reputation, could do is they could look at submissions by human rights organizations and lawyers saying that certain officials in Russia, Azerbaijan, Ukraine, Georgia really have been named in European court decisions, have systematically violated human rights, and there is a strong enough case not to seize assets, because that requires a level of legal clarity that is very hard to achieve, and most Europeans would refrain from that. But withdrawing the right to travel, which is a privilege. So not to do what Bill Browder has done, but to basically say there are many Russians who would like to travel to the EU and don't get to travel because of some reason that has nothing to do with human rights, because the EU, some country, fears they might be illegal immigrants. So if there are human rights violators, if there is a mechanism to assess cases, and if this is transparent, if these individuals find out, in fact, the very process of, and you don't need to have large numbers, the very process of there being this option, I think would work very well. Why? Because what we saw in the reactions by Russia to debates in the Irish parliament on the Magnitsky list, for example, because the Irish came close to passing it, was huge nervousness, an enormous mobilization, great pressure on the foreign ministry in Ireland. Then the argument, well, if you do this, you won't be able to adopt Russian children. I mean, all the... Because I think this really does, you know, strike at the sense of security of some of those elites. And by taking away the right to travel to Europe, in fact, you don't need to seize the assets. Now, the UK is not in Schengen, so they would have to have another mechanism. But I think if such a committee would recommend once a year to the European Council, here are 10 people this year we recommend for these and these reasons, shouldn't be allowed to travel to Schengen, it would be very difficult for the European Council, for member states, and even for the UK to ignore this. They would have to explain this. So I think this kind of visa ban could actually work. But it needs to be transparent and visible. The whole point of it is that it's visible. If it's some sort of deal between some governments, let's do something against 5 Belarusians now, and it doesn't have this effect. And it should be open-ended, to that you can add more people over time. So this is one recommendation. We also think the Council of Europe needs to create such a committee to assess cases of political prisoners quicker than the European Court does. Again, in a non-binding way, but with the similar sort of credibility. There is now a definition in the Council of Europe of political prisoners. And in all countries where is the suspicion of systematic abuse, which, for example, the Human Rights Commissioner could establish, or the General Secretary, or the Parliamentary Assembly, or a member state, you would then have a mechanism to assess more quickly. That has been done before also. You know, whether in Azerbaijan or Russia, certain cases. And you don't need to wait 3 or 4 years for the European Court. Okay, these are technical proposals, but I think it's very important to have the debates like this, because if you don't have concrete proposals that can get a majority, you know, it's just idle, you know. It makes us feel good, but it doesn't work. On the bigger issue of the human rights language in Ukraine, I think the fundamental problem was, I mean, there was really bad luck in Ukraine, that when they had their Orange Revolution, it was 2005, and 2005 was the year the EU moved away from the concept of enlargement for a very clear reason, and I know it in Germany. In the German Bundestag, there was a resolution prepared by the then opposition, which was led by Angela Merkel, because she was leader of the faction in the Bundestag, the CDU, to call on the government to offer Ukraine a European perspective and do more for Ukraine. This was prepared in the spring of 2005. And then the French and the Dutch voted down the constitutional treaty. And then there was, in the summer, this big sense in Europe, oh, we don't know what to do now. Later, of course, you had the Lisbon Treaty, and most of what was in the constitutional treaty has somehow been rescued. But the reading of that crisis, of this double referendum in the Netherlands and in France, in Germany, was that the CDU immediately withdrew this text, and it disappeared. And I talked to the people who prepared it, it was gone. So at the very moment when we had our two color revolutions in Georgia and in Ukraine, when the EU might have offered just a very long distance perspective that would give me the right to then be more credibly involved in shaping the agenda, to tell the Georgians or Ukrainians more clearly, you know, what kind of behavior was not very constructive or what was not going to lead them anywhere, the EU basically abdicated, left. And so after... Saakashvili is another example. He traveled, his first year, he traveled all over Europe. I mean, his first trips to France and Germany. He then gave up on Europe completely. And he found his friends in the US, you know, neocons and libertarians and people who believe in putting lots of people in prison. And
wait, is there some causality here? The fact that Europe didn't step to the plate led to Saakashvili going
I think there was. I think the fact that Europe became, you know, offered no perspective at all. A lot of the Georgians I talked to in those years, you know, when I say to them, look, you should look to the Estonians. You know, the Estonians believe in a free market. They are liberals, right? But they also believe that their only real security and way to economic development was to create the regulatory institutions that allow foreign direct investment, which Georgia never got, except into real estate. And the Georgians always say, yeah, but the Estonians had a perspective. I mean, we just don't have any. It's just not real. So they focused on NATO and they focused on America. And in Ukraine, of course, the big disaster was the complete lack of direction and incompetence of the post-Orange Revolution governments, I think. I mean, this was the... So, in a sense, if there would have been a clearer perspective, and I think that's also true now. Now, why... What does a perspective mean? I think there the problem is also the instruments. At the moment, I think if the European Union would set out, and this is a very technical proposal, but I think it's very, very important. Look at the OECD, a very boring organization of economists, and its PISA test. Here's an organization of economists in Paris that devised a way to assess countries that a 14-year-old understands. You know, you do these tests of 14-year-olds, people after 8 years in school, you test how good they are in reading, math, and science, and then you can rank countries. That's all they do since 12 years. It revolutionized the global debate on education. Now, lots of people are critical of the details, but lots of people discussed it. And in a country like Germany or Sweden, talked to some Swedish MPs recently, they say this might decide the next election because Sweden has slipped very far, and you know, it's a big topic. The key about these kinds of rankings is that they stimulate debates on issues. I think if the EU accession process, and on visa liberalization, that's what the EU also did, you know, defining 50 very concrete criteria which Balkan countries had to meet in order to get visa liberalization, visa-free travel. This was very strict because interior ministries in Europe were very skeptical. They looked at this. They didn't want to give Albania visa-free travel. The French fought until the very end. But there were very strict and clear conditions set out, which wasn't just passing laws but creating institutions. When these were met, it was a trap for both sides. Governments had to meet these conditions, and when they were met, EU member states found it much harder to resist the logic of allowing, giving them what they had promised. If this would be how we structure the EU accession process, if the EU would much more clearly spell out what countries actually need to do substantively and communicate this in ways that are understandable, because now it's a totally esoteric process. Talk to Turks about EU accession, and you get into a debate that is surreal. It's about opening a chapter. Should the EU open a chapter? You ask, and these are people who work on the EU, and you ask them, all right, what happens when you open a chapter? What is this thing? What, physically, who calls whom? Well, there's a meeting. And then what happens? Well, then we have a negotiation. What kind of negotiation? Well, there isn't actually a negotiation. Actually, nothing happens when you open a chapter. It's a purely bureaucratic step. Because as we've seen, and we showed it in our last report, reforms in those countries happen as much in closed chapters as in opened ones. So we've taken a completely meaningless measure that has become a completely silly, you know, mark of progress that nobody believes in.
Okay, but Gerald, let's say you totally sort of jettison the language of chapters and the like. At the end of the day, the acquis itself, the defined enlargement, they're fairly straightforward principles, no?
Well, I mean, take Turkey now. There is the issue of public procurement. You know, that goes away from human rights, but I think it's pretty important seeing what's happening in Turkey now in terms of spending public money. The issue of public procurement, where there is actually, there's some very clear, I can explain that to a 14-year-old, what the EU principles on public procurement are. It's not a panacea. There are problems with public procurement in Germany, in France, in Bulgaria. But it is much better having some of those mechanisms. I mean, these principles are relatively clear. The EU hasn't spelled...
How we know this? To what extent the experience of Hungary or Bulgaria or Romania gives you a kind of an argument to claim that simply adopting these mechanisms leads to a quality transformative change? Because your major assumption is that the major social change is the European enlargement. And by the way, very consistently saying this for years. And in my view now, this is more problematic than it was 5 years ago. Giving European perspective to Ukraine probably is a good policy, but are you sure that this is a policy which is transforming the country in the way you assume? This is my question.
Well, I think there are lots of caveats. And the first one is it must be credible. Now, to be credible, it must be credible also in member states. That's the fundamental problem. Because at the moment we have an EU accession process with lots of countries, they're all blocked by vetoes. Macedonia is blocked by Greece. Turkey is blocked by Cyprus. Kosovo is blocked by non-recognition. Bosnia is blocked by some other strange conditions. So, in fact, we are having at the moment a non-credible process. So it's
But go back. You assume. Yes. My idea is there are countries that there was a credible perspective, that they are now in the EU, and probably the transformative power of the accession was much more limited than we assumed. So basically, Hungary had a this process of accession, you have this institutional transformation. And if you go on the rights issues, I don't believe that you can claim that, for example, now they're better than they have been 5 or 10 years ago. So my idea is, to what extent the outside pressure on which you're betting is enough, to what extent ignoring politics, this is why I'm pushing on this, can you have a successful human rights advocacy if you're totally divorcing it from the domestic democratic political process?
Okay, let's take Hungary. Is it really fair to say, when a country has joined in 2004 and at that time had one of the best constitutional courts, you know, was praised for its constitutional court, and then many years later, you know, this is undone by a strange combination of circumstances where a strange election law leads to a supermajority with actually not that many votes? Is it fair to blame that on enlargement? I don't think so.
No.
That's like blaming Berlusconi on any democracy can always move backwards. I mean, the idea that enlargement ends history and that then democracies are safe and sound and nothing wrong can happen. There, I totally agree with you. The interesting debate then becomes, and this is why the issue of having clear standards for accession candidates is also useful for inside the EU. When the EU or the Council of Europe then goes to Hungary and says, we have a problem with your approach to media or the judiciary, it's not that easy because, of course, now they are in. So you need to have very strong and convincing arguments. Now, I don't know the Hungarian case that well, but what I understand what they are doing is they then say, well, most of your arguments are just not true, because what we have elsewhere. You know, other European countries have such systems. So I think what we need to be better at is defining red lines that cannot be crossed, also for EU members. And it is, in fact, then a political process. It doesn't become a legal process. Once you're a member, the super weapon of suspending your voting right won't be used. But as a political process, to say, here are some red lines, and we find, European Parliament finds, the Venice Commission finds, that they have been crossed. And that puts pressure in the European People's Party to talk differently to the Hungarian member of the European People's Party. That puts pressure. I think this is actually the direction in which we need to go. The problem is that as the autocrats also inside the EU, or people who've been playing with these standards, many years after they've joined, and this includes some very old members, as they are very sophisticated, it's not enough to just say human rights and Hungary is violating freedom of speech. We need to be more precise what that means. And as we see, even in the accession context, very often we are not very clear on what we mean. I think this is where the problem comes in.
Can I have one sentence? Because for me this is critically important. In the democratic process with rights, we have certain type of rights and you're struggling for them. The same-sex marriage is a great story. Dividing issue, all over, difficult. And then basically we're coming to a country like Ukraine or Moldova, where this debate has not started yet. You have the Orthodox Church, which is very conservative, and you're coming with the highest level, highest standards of human rights, which is not supported by their democratic political process. No, I'm trying to make it, because I do believe it's going to be a very major issue in some of these countries. And then, basically, they can adopt it. They're adopting this, but there is no political constituency to defend it. I mean, strong enough, politically strong enough. So when they're going to be a backlash, I totally agree with you that nobody can prevent the backlashes. This is how democracy functions. You end up with rights that nobody defends domestically, politically. And from this point of view, for me, my major story is to what extent we're focusing on building political constituencies, voting constituencies of certain rights, or to what extent basically we use the European accession process much more to change the level of standards and basically high standards for this. And this is an interesting question. I don't know what is the right answer, but I do believe it's a real issue. It cannot be just taken for granted. Yeah.
Can I say one thing? I agree with you if the condition would be same-sex marriage, but it is not. I mean, the condition that the EU is putting to Ukraine is basic non-discrimination, which means no hate speech, no discrimination. You know, what the EU is discussing on gay rights is in fact a red line, and it has defined it relatively well, which is basically, you know, a core human right that all these countries have signed up to with the European Convention already. So I think, of course, the EU can't come to Ukraine and say, we want you to do something which Croatia and Malta don't have either. This would not be credible. I agree with that. So, you know, activists can do that, but it's not for the European institutions, because in fact we wouldn't be credible. There's no constituency. They would say, why should we? But if it is something as basic as, you know, non-discrimination, you know, in a non-discrimination mechanism, which in Georgia, we had the Georgian deputy foreign minister recently at an event we did 3 weeks ago, where he was talking about the visa story and the difficulty of non-discrimination law. Moldova, the Moldovan deputy foreign minister, the visa story. And he said, he actually defended this EU conditionality on this. He said it was very tough for us, but it was very useful for us. Because in fact, what we were talking about was a non-discrimination mechanism which wasn't just for sexual minorities, it was also for other minorities. It's very basic, it doesn't turn Moldova into a country of, you know. But it is the kind of discussion which we had in our own country, and it does create some constituencies if it is led early enough. I think the skepticism that is completely justified and I share is one where the EU says, or where it's perceived that the EU says to countries, adopt these laws, then we you know, it's a check, and then you can join. I mean, that is absurd, because that can be reversed very quickly. But I give you one last example that we looked at, which is minority situation in Slovakia. You know, Christoph did a lot of research on the Hungarians in Slovakia. Because Slovakia is a perfect case. They have a very autocratic government until 1998, you know, Mečiar. The EU says you can't join like this. There is this coalition that overthrows him in elections. There is this reform government. They do everything right. They overtake everybody. They finish accession talks. They give the Hungarians a state-funded university, public university. They join the EU, and then they're overthrown, and the bad guys come back. So it fits perfectly into the backlash theory. Our question, empirically, was, and what happened then? And what we saw was that between 2006 and 2010, you know, with the worst populists back in power, you know, and I'm not talking about the Prime Minister, I'm talking about Mecha and Slotter, and, you know, the rhetoric of these guys is
fascist. It didn't get
fascist.
So bad.
Actually, they achieved very, very little. The University of the Hungarians is still there. The Hungarian rights of language rights are still superior to almost any other EU member. Most of the laws which were, you know, on that made it into the press, when The Economist wrote about some crazy laws about forbidding people to speak Hungarian at public events, when The New York Times wrote about it, people in Bratislava didn't actually manage to get them passed. The president didn't sign them. So 4 years later, and this, I think, is the real test. It isn't that populists come back and want to reverse things. That is, in fact, to be expected. I expect this in Croatia, too. It is whether then there are the constituencies, the mechanisms, the institutions to defend it then. And there, I think, the record is still mixed, but much better than we're giving it credit for.
Because you have the, but you have the Hungarian voters in Slovakia, which is a political, there is a constituency, very clear. By the way, one of the smart things that the European Union can do is having this, and I agree very much, basic anti-discrimination story, putting the language minorities and the sexual minorities together. And let's see how the Russians are going to react.
And people
because
with physical
when you're basically starting to protect at one and the same time gays and lesbians and the Russian speakers in the East, I want to see, because it's also anti-discrimination talk, and of course, then I want to see how they're going to campaign in the way they're campaigning now. Because Mr. Azarov, the Prime Minister, went in front of speaking to the rally of the Party of the Region and said they want us to have a free visa regime, but they want to adopt the same-sex marriage. We know that this is not true. But because there is no debate in the country on this, people are buying this. So from my point of view, it's should European Union go much more political and much more trying to basically go into domestic politics and this type of a constituency building, or we should really believe that it's about assessment, about the judges to be appointed, and kind of this level, which in my view is slightly easier, but slightly less sustainable.
But it's obviously both.
But they don't always go so easy together. Don't forget my Timoshenko story, which I asked you and didn't respond. If we were principled there...
I actually am not sure about this, because we started... You know, accession talks with a lot of countries, I mean Turkey, when their human rights record was really still very, very bad. I mean, we said, in fact, for Turkey that they just sufficiently fulfilled the human rights, the Copenhagen political criteria, just sufficiently, doesn't mean they didn't. And I think on Timoshenko, having an association agreement, making this dependent on this, you know, you can debate. I have no clear opinion. I don't. But I don't think it's a question of principle. I don't think the EU would have forgiven its, would have abandoned its principles if it would have said, you know, it's for the European Court. I think if an EU member state would have taken Ukraine in the Council of Europe, you know, would have had the courage to do something there, you know, to where the mechanisms exist, then the EU could have done its association agreement in the meantime. I believe that we should use these instruments much more with a division of labor. You know, the EU can engage Azerbaijan on energy and the Council of Europe, the same governments, because this is about human rights and democracy, can use this podium, this arena for much more sharp criticism. But I think if, you know, an association agreement was signed with Turkey in 1963, just after one coup, and they had another three since, and the association agreement is still in place. And I think it was a good thing that it exists.
Any other comments, Beka Vucho?
Well, Sandy asked about your presumption. What's going to happen with the elections, European elections?
Parliamentary elections.
What do you think? How is it going to change the situation?
I mean, you know what the conventional wisdom is, that the next European Parliament will be much less, much more populist, much less pro-European. But that really remains to be seen. I spent part of my time in France, and it is a bit scary how energized the Front National is. You know, they are the ones who give us a leaflet every 2 days in front of our apartment. And of course, there's a very peculiar political situation in France now. It is, however, also noteworthy that what they are trying to do, I don't buy any of it, but they are trying to very consciously move to the center to get rid of their old, you know, more obnoxious people. I hope the French see through that. But if you take Germany or other countries, you know, in Germany, you know, the anti-Euro party is not really. You know, this is very different from the Front National. It has nothing to do with except that they also don't like the euro. It's nothing to do with some of the proto-fascist parties in other countries. You know, it's a party of professors who are against the euro, and you know, I disagree with their arguments, but I mean, they're totally democratic. Otherwise, in Germany, which is the biggest country, I don't think we will see any strong anti-European forces in the European Parliament. I think the same is true in a lot of other countries. So it really depends what the arithmetic will be. But I think in the end, the European Parliament will probably change less than we now predict. I mean, it might be wrong because it's so many 28 different constituencies, but I suspect it will change less. And there's an institutional interest in the European Parliament to be for certain things. So I also don't think it will proceed to dismantle itself right after the elections.
And the future of Martin Schulz, if the socialists do win, do you see him as becoming...
I think these top posts in Europe are appointed, you always, the one you bet on never gets it. So for on this reason, I would suspect his chances are pretty low because so many people have written about him having this position, and in the end, it's the member states who need to agree.
Okay. Any other comments, questions? Gerald, thank you so much. This was great.
Now, a lot of this is on our website, and there will be more reports on this. On political prisoners, we're running a campaign, a sort of slogan, Europe Without Political Prisoners 2014, where we hope to... I mean, at least as a goal, as an aspiration.
Are there political prisoners in Europe?
Well, there are. I mean, I think there are a number of countries which...
I didn't know that.
No, he does not mean EU. He means Europe.
I mean Europe. I mean Europe, yes.
Okay, right,
I think the Bolotnaya and the Azerbaijan, they've arrested 100... people who I think
Azerbaijan
is in the Council of Europe, of course. It's in the OEC. It's in every European organization except the EU. So, you know, I started at the beginning. We've expanded all these European institutions. Now we need to save them. Or we shouldn't have expanded them.
Thank you very much, Gerald.
No, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.